When are people going to see that nothing ain't never going to change unless somebody finally makes up its mind to stand up and fight? Damn.
Netrich Radio presents Hopping Mad with Will McLeod and Arliss Bunny. Now, here's Will and Arliss.
Welcome to Hopping Mad. I'm Will McLeod.
And I'm Arliss Bunny.
Today, we'll be talking about some breaking news involving Donald Trump. But first, we have a few stories. Arliss?
Our friends on Irreverent Testimony have a libertarian friend, and they've been having an ongoing discussion with him about voting for Hillary. And he said that he would give her his vote if he could find out how she plans to pay for debt-free college. So I have the answer to that right here, right now on Hopping Mad. The first thing Hillary wants to do is something she's calling the fair share surcharge. In 2013, the 400 highest income taxpayers in the country were making an average of $250 million a year and paying an effective tax rate of only 23%. In fact, 25% of them are paying at a rate of less than 20%. The top 400 are currently paying well below what they were paying in the 1990s when both they and the economy were thriving. Hillary intends to ensure that the functional tax rate on the people at the top is the same as the functional tax rate on the people in the middle of the income pyramid in this country. She will impose a 4% fair share surcharge on those making more than $5 million a year, and that is 0.02% of taxpayers. Everyone making more than $1 million a year will pay at a rate of 30%, which is as it should be. The next thing she wants to do is restore the estate tax on large estates. So right at the top, I should say those large estates do not include small business, family farms, family heirlooms, and personal property. She's taking those things out. And those are the things that cause people concern when the discussion comes to estate tax. She wants to go back to the 2009 parameters. And for estates valued in the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, she wants to have a graduated estate tax. She also wants to close the loopholes that allow estates to be valued at far below their actual worth. She wants to impose a risk fee on SIFIs, systemically important financial institutions. So this would go beyond Dodd-Frank, and it would be a graduated fee on the liabilities of SIFIs and would raise $150 billion over 10 years. And that, by the way, is something you can tell to your friends who say that she's pro-bank and pro-Wall Street. Capital gains. Hillary's been on this for more than a decade. She's been calling for increased taxation on capital gains on short-term investments. This would mean that long-term investments become a more favorable thing for Wall Street, and that's good for the economy as a whole. She would redefine the tax code to weed out actual long-term investments from tax shelters. For very high-income families, bequests of investments would be treated as the realization event. When somebody dies and they pass their estate along, that is the point at which a capital gain occurs. So at that point, taxation would also occur. And again, there would be an exception for small business, family farms, family heirlooms, and personal property. There's a lot more detail to this, but I will put on our website a link to the part of Hillary's website that specifies this down to minutia. Hillary wants to also close certain tax loopholes, including the Bermuda reinsurance loophole. This is specifically designed derivatives, initially designed by Deutsche Bank and Barclays, for tax avoidance because they're set up to look like capital gains. And usually most of the structures for that are done in Bermuda, which is why it's called foreign or Bermuda reinsurance loopholes. She wants to close the Romney loophole. About 1,000 Americans have accumulated close to $100 billion in tax-preferred retirement accounts. This exceeds $10 million per taxpayer. Hillary would want to limit the amount that can be stored in a retirement account tax-free. She also wants to close the interest carried loophole. Hillary has been calling for this, again, for more than a decade. When a Wall Street money manager exceeds a set level of return on investment, it's called a hurdle rate, and they're paid a bonus after that point. This bonus is, for some bizarre reason, not classified as income. It's classified as a capital gain and therefore not taxed. Hillary wants to turn that around, close the carried interest loophole. Those things all together is how Hillary plans to pay for debt-free college. It's entirely doable, and that should be the answer that Travis and Rachel need. Will?
Guccifer 2.0 and WikiLeaks have both released information quote-unquote information on Hillary Clinton that is entirely false. The speech transcripts they've released, the documents that they've released from the Clinton Foundation don't appear to be valid at all. The Clinton Foundation has said that these things aren't valid. They say, we don't know what those documents are. They didn't come from us. We weren't breached. And if you take a look at the supposed speech transcripts, they also look like complete BS. Let's go through one of them. There's this one that says, thank you. Please close the doors. This is Lloyd Blankfein speaking, supposedly. Please close the doors and ensure you have no electronic recording devices of any kind. Let me remind you that this discussion is under NDA. Now, this is patently absurd for two reasons. Number one, this is supposedly at a banquet. You don't have non-disclosure agreement conversations at a banquet. And furthermore, you aren't going to take everybody's cell phone at a banquet. And you're definitely not going to have any conversation you wouldn't want getting out, because the fact is, at these banquets, you have people's girlfriends, boyfriends, wives, children, people who've come along because they're friends and want to go to a big fancy dinner with their banker friends. This is not a place where you would have a private conversation. So already in the first sentence, this doesn't pass the smell test. But moving along from there, when Hillary Clinton supposedly starts talking, it says, thank you, Lloyd. Friends, distinguished members of Goldman Sachs. Distinguished members?
Members.
This language doesn't make sense. There's no one who talks that way. Members of Goldman Sachs?
You say members of Congress. You don't say members of Goldman Sachs.
Exactly. I mean, it's like someone was passingly familiar with speeches made by American politicians and pulled various phrases out. And here's the big thing. This speech was supposedly in 2012. As you know, we are in preparation for the 2016 presidential campaign, and I am here both to ask for your support and to appraise you of et cetera, et cetera. If Hillary Clinton had announced at a Goldman Sachs event in 2012 that she was running for president, they would have told their friends in the media. That would have leaked.
Twitter would have burned down.
Exactly. We would have known if something like that were said. If she'd announced she was running for president in 2012, it would have exploded. We would have known about it. But we didn't, because she never said that. And it continues to be just as bad as that. There's this line that says, historically, the Republican Party has been the party most aligned with Wall Street and the financial services industry. Not true. It's not true at all. In fact, one of the main reasons that Occupy Wall Street existed was because the financial industry on Wall Street has relationships with people in both parties. It really has developed relationships with politicians from both sides of the aisle for a reason. And there are people in the financial services industry that tend to lean more left-wing, especially on social issues. And there are also people in the financial services industry who like the Koch brothers. So there's a divide there. And Hillary Clinton is the person who has promised in this race that she's going to appoint judges that will overturn Citizens United. That's the main political thing here. But this idea that, you know, the Republican Party and the Wall Street interests have always been aligned, that's not true. And Clinton wouldn't say that because it's so obviously not true. And then there's a talk of a Republican establishment firewall, firewall being language from the 2016 election. Moving on from there, you get to this line, what we see on the left is in its way more disconcerting, talking about the left somehow being divided. And in 2012, that wasn't true. Yes, you'd had Occupy Wall Street, but the people who'd come out for all those marches, the hundreds of thousands of Americans, the millions of Americans who were upset about the overrepresentation of Wall Street were backing the Democratic Party. The left was united in lockstep behind Barack Obama and trying to get a Democratic Congress. There wasn't any disconcerting division on the left. This is something crafted to talk about the 2016 election. You can see that in the final paragraph on this one page where it just says, you know, this bucket of losers could only be a significant force in the next election, but could, on an outside percentile, even win. Then it just has the lines that say chaos. If Hillary Clinton had said that there was a third party candidate that could have won, which is not true because of math, it would have, again, been big, big news.
So they also brought up bucket of losers, which is supposed to cause everybody to think about basket of deplorables. Again, that's a non sequitur. It wouldn't have been there in the speech.
Absolutely not. No, this is intentionally designed to make someone think that basket of deplorables was a thing. This is something WikiLeaks released. This is something that the Trump folks have been passing around all day, and it's clearly BS. So we know for a fact that earlier emails that supposedly were from the DNC were doctored because there were Cyrillic tags which means they were operated, they were manipulated under a computer that had Russian language settings. But we know that the people who are around Guccifer 2.0 speak better Russian than they do Romanian. We know for a fact that this looks really, really like Russian propaganda. So there's no reason to trust any of it, especially if it looks like it was translated poorly by someone with a passing familiarity with how American politicians talk. So this stuff is obviously nonsense. And on that note, coming up, we are going to talk about what happened with Donald Trump over the weekend here on Hopping Mad.
We're back on Hopping Mad, and Will and I plan this show in advance. We really do, and we work hard at our plan, and we work hard on our chosen topics. But this week, all that went out the window. I was originally going to talk about the lies that Trump told during the first debate. I had talked about some of the economic lies last week, and I was going to finish that up this week.
And I was going to talk about the red pill, men's rights activists, and all these other anti-woman misogynistic groups that have been organizing online in recent years. They're called the new misogyny, even though, as Arliss has pointed out quite rightly, there's nothing new about it, but just the methods of organization that they're using. But all that being said, we had to focus on the really disgusting things that it's been revealed Donald Trump has said.
And it's not just what he said. He'd said those things, and that news came out on Friday, and we were still going to do our show. But then Republicans started to react. And that's when things got serious.
Yeah. And what's weird about that is that apparently you can say really terrible things about individual women. You can say really terrible things about Mexicans, about Black Americans, about Asians, about any group you want to.
About disabled Americans.
About disabled Americans. But the moment you say something collectively about white women, that's where the Republicans draw the line.
Of course they do.
It's literally the party of the far-right white nationalist stuff here, the sanctity of our women and all that other paternalistic crap. But you stood by this guy, Republicans. You stood by him when he called women pigs, when he said that all Mexicans were rapists, that Mexico doesn't send their best to the United States, denigrating all American Mexicans, who some might be good people, but there's plenty of rapists and criminals there. You Republicans stood by this man when he said all that. And it's just, we're still going to hang him around your neck. But they
abso-frickin-lutely.
But they know that. They're just in total cowardly self-preservation mode at this point. Where they're like, I could lose my job now. This has become so bad that it's starting to threaten me personally. So that being the case, I'm now going to jump ship. And that's what it is. It's like rats from a sinking ship at this point.
Here's the news as it's come along. First of all, this story was broken by Washington Post reporter David Farenthold. And the thing about him is that he's been doing some of the most exceptional work on tracking down the Trump Foundation and the money behind that and what's been going on there. This is a man who deserves the Pulitzer. One way or another, he has done some of the most straight-ahead, hardcore investigative reporting this entire election cycle. Really very impressive. So hat tip to the Washington Post. The second thing that's worth pointing out here at the top is Mike Pence's response to this. Because there's an awful lot of pressure being put on Trump to step aside and allow Mike Pence to ascend to the top of the ticket. First of all, Trump is too much of a narcissist to do that, right, Will?
Right. Right. In fact, he's already tweeted that he will never abandon his supporters. Hashtag make America great again.
In all caps.
He's already. Yeah, it's basically a middle finger to the Republican Party saying, I'm the nominee, I'm not going anywhere. So unless they can find some kind of like loophole somewhere where they can have him declared mentally unfit, but I don't know that such loophole exists. I think that if that loophole existed, we'd know about it by now.
Yes, we'd know. Apparently, a meeting was held that seems to be what's kind of floating around on the web, that there was a meeting held at the RNC in D.C., and their lawyers told them they couldn't get Trump off the ticket. Among other things, ballots have been mailed out in a number of states. So ballots are printed everywhere and ballots have been mailed out in a number of states. So they really are backed into a corner on this. Mike Pence has this to say about this whole thing. As a husband and father, I was offended by the words and actions described by Donald Trump in the 11-year-old video released yesterday. I do not condone his remarks and cannot defend them. I'm grateful that he has expressed remorse and apologized to the people. We pray for his family and look forward to the opportunity he has to show what is in his heart when he goes before the nation tomorrow night. Seriously? Seriously? First of all, it doesn't matter if it's an 11-year-old video. If any man ever thought that, as far as I'm concerned, he's disqualified from the White House. Period. End of story. Done.
Yeah. Yeah. I just am
There's
so totally...
There's no apologizing out of this.
Also, I was going to talk about the Red Pillars and the MRAs, the misogynistic groups that we're talking about, and what they are saying. And what Trump has said, and his basket of deplorables have backed him up on this, is that, well, this is just what guys talk about in locker rooms. And as a guy who's been in locker rooms rather a lot, who spends time with plenty of male friends, and who's been in jocular situations, and who's been in sort of those sports situations and team situations and locker room situations before,
right.
No, we don't talk about sexually assaulting women. We don't talk about grabbing women without their permission. That's not something that we talk about. And if you're with a group of people who's talking about sexually assaulting women as something that's fun, you need to tell them to shut up. That's absolutely disgusting. I don't know what man would sit back and let those disgusting comments just get a pass. He's talking about sexually assaulting women.
Well,
and
Hillary had it right. Basket of deplorables.
Exactly. It's infuriating.
It really is. I do think, I mean, the thing that caused Will and I to really actually pitch our show out the door was when Will came across a Politico article saying that the RNC on Saturday, today, which is when we're recording the show, put a temporary halt on the spending of their victory program for electing Donald Trump. They shut down the money.
Yeah, they sent out an email to their vendors saying that they'd put a hold on all projects. And the committee told them, even if you're in the middle of something, just stop it. We'll update you. They told their staffers to continue operating as if nothing had changed. But those staffers are in rebellion. Some of them have quit. Some of them have decided, okay, I'm going to keep my position at the RNC, but I'm going to go focus on Senate races and try to keep the Senate and the House, because that's where we need to go right now, because we are so totally screwed by this situation. So the RNC has rebellion, they have defection, and they've turned off the money supply. This is, so far, at this stage, a complete disaster for the Republican Party. And good, because they built this.
Yes, this was their dream. They worked at it hard. And among those people that worked at it hard were commentators like hard-right Christian commentator Eric Erickson. I was so entertained by this. And he's saying this on Friday. This morning, polling showed 40% of Protestant pastors in the U.S. were undecided in 2016. That's probably much less tonight. Yeah, that's the understatement of the year. Ralph Reed of the Christian Coalition, we all remember Ralph Reed, thinks that this will probably have very little impact. Once again, Ralph Reed, incredibly, incredibly wrong. The one that entertains me the most, the one I think is the most actually stunning, is the Mormon Church. First of all, Mormons, fourth largest denomination in the U.S., 5.5 million members here in this country, and they vote heavily. Mormons roll out and vote. The Deseret News, which is owned by the church, that's their newspaper, made a statement for the very first time in its entire history on the presidential race. In that statement, they said, "What oozes from this audio is evil. We hear a married man give smooth, smug, and self-congratulatory permission to his intense impulses, allowing them to outweigh the most modest sense of decency, fidelity, and commitment. And although it speaks volumes about sexual morality, it goes to the heart of all ethical behavior. Trump's banter belies a willingness to use and discard other human beings at will. That characteristic is the essence of a despot."
Wow.
Yeah, that from the Deseret News, the conservative Deseret News. They've told Trump to drop out, and it is a clear sign that the LDS leadership, which claims to be nonpartisan, is spreading this nationally to all of their membership. Something else farther in this story, they said, from Proverbs 29, "When the wicked beareth rule, the people mourn." So the Mormons are on the warpath. And there are a number of Mormon legislators in the U.S. Congress and Senate, in governor's mansions in this country. Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho, who is Mormon, has decided to unendorse Trump. Governor Gary Herbert of Utah, unendorsing. Senator Mike Lee says, "You, sir, are a distraction. I respectfully ask, with all due respect, that you step aside and step down." Jason Chaffetz says, "I'm out. I can no longer in good conscience endorse this person for president."
Orrin Hatch. And I won't vote for him.
Yeah. Orrin Hatch has still not withdrawn his endorsement formally, but came out with a highly critical statement. Representative Chris Stewart, Representative Mia Love. The Mormon Church put out a statement months ago to counter Trump's anti-Muslim ban because they identify with religious persecution in this country. And so they were already tentative about him. This has pushed them over the edge, and it flies in the face of their basic principles. 5.5 million Mormons. Now, I don't know that they turn around and vote Hillary, but I'm sure they won't vote Trump at this point.
Yeah, me too. There will be a percentage of them who do, but most of them won't. And also, I want to say, there are left-wing Mormons as well. Harry Reid. Harry Reid is a Mormon. And one of the statements that Arliss cued me into earlier, which was great, was John Kasich's statement, where he comes out, he's kind of grinning when he said this. Here's the written statement. "Nothing that has happened in the last 48 hours is surprising to me or many others. Many people were angry and questioned why I would not endorse Donald Trump or attend the Republican convention. I've long had concerns with Donald Trump that go beyond his temperament. We have substantive policy differences on conservative issues like trade, our relationship with Russia, and the importance of balancing the federal budget. I've held out hope that he would change on those disqualifying policy questions, but he has not. I've also encouraged him to change his behavior for the better and offer a positive, inclusive vision for our country, but he has not. It's clear that he hasn't changed and has no interest in doing so. As a result, Donald Trump is a man I cannot and should not support. The actions of the last day are disgusting, but that's not why I reached this decision. It's been an accumulation of his words and actions that many have been warning about. I will not vote for a nominee who has behaved in a manner that reflects so poorly on our country. Our country deserves better." And he said it with a grin because he was happy to tell everyone he told you so.
It warms my heart. I think my very favorite comment from a Republican comes from Senator John Bozeman. And let's just point out, this is somebody I've never once in my entire life agreed with. But he had this to say: "If I ever heard anyone speak this way about my daughters and granddaughters, they would be stopping for a new set of teeth. I am focused on saving the U.S. Senate." I mean, these guys are cutting and running like rats off a sinking ship. It is freaking amazing. What was really interesting to me was the responses from Republican women. First of all, white college-educated women are a must-win demographic for Trump. People have been saying that for quite some time. That's been made very clear in this election. McCain and Romney won this demo by 53% and still lost the election. So Trump actually needs a bigger number than that, and he's nowhere close. His earlier statements and behavior had already done considerable harm. Remember, talk about Fox News host Megyn Kelly, what he said to Carla Fiorina, what he said about Heidi Cruz, what he said about Alicia Machado. So this last thing, GOP women are over it. Senator Kelly Ayotte, who just this last week was saying that she hoped that her children would look up to Donald Trump, has pulled her endorsement of Trump and is planning to write in Mike Pence's name. Senator Deb Fischer, Senators Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, New Hampshire GOP Chair Jennifer Horn, Rep. Barbara Comstock, Rep. Martha Roby, Rep. Ann Wagner, West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Caputo, Alex Smith, who's the first female president of the College Republican National Committee. These are all people who have pulled their support of Trump. And I think we haven't even begun to see the ripple effect of this. I think he's done. I think Trump is toast. A high-ranking New Hampshire Republican said this to her state newspaper: "This just confirms the concerns that those women have had all along. It's worse, but it's not unsuspected. And it's not just center-right women. In New Hampshire, we really have to worry about independent voters. No one wins New Hampshire without the independent vote. I think this just confirms it for these people who have had concerns. It's what they suspected all along." And that is, I think, insightful. And it goes with something that Richard Wolff said in The Guardian. He said, in 2008, you could sense it in the 24-hour period around the first debate, when John McCain suspended his campaign, then revived his campaign, ahead of his big moment on stage with Barack Obama. Erratic was the rap then against John McCain, and erratic was how he behaved. 4 years later, it came with the 47% video of Mitt Romney talking at a private fundraiser. He was an out-of-touch elitist in his caricature, and that's how Romney sounded behind closed doors. Now we have the grotesque video of Donald Trump bragging, "Grab them by the pussy, you can do anything." With it, Trump showed he is indeed the sum of all the sexist snippets we have heard so far. The basket of deplorables just found their Mr. Universe. There is no point in pretending that Trump can claw his way back from here. He has now confirmed that he disdains women, and many women voters will surely return the favor. That's absolutely true. I think women are done. I don't think women need to hear any more. I don't think there's any form of apology that makes this good. I think Trump is toast.
I think women and people who care about women are done. If you are someone who has a wife or a sister or a mother or a daughter, I don't know how you can listen to these comments and want anything to do with this guy.
Yeah.
Although, you know, the basket of deplorables, they're backing him, including Spreaker's number one right-wing political radio guy, a guy named Bill Mitchell, who has said, LOL, the Democrats think the Trump train is discouraged. We just stopped for new tires. Because that's how trains work. It's they have tires.
Oh, my God. You have to love it, don't you?
Yeah. And another thing that is just warming the cockles of my heart is Bill Pruitt. As a producer on seasons 1 and 2 of The Apprentice, I assure you, when it comes to the Trump tapes, there are far worse. Just the beginning.
Oh, my gosh. I can't wait. I can't wait.
Yeah.
Finally, these things are coming out. It's great.
Coming up, we have an interview with Matt Campbell, which if you want to see what the U.S. might look like under Trump, take a look at the U.K. under Theresa May. It's a great interview. I really encourage you to stick around here on Hopping Mad. Back to Hopping Mad. Matt Campbell grew up in England, but moved to Scotland, where he is an advocate of Scottish independence. He's an elected councillor for the Scottish National Party, a leading voice in Inverclyde, the convener of English Scots for Independence. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So I've been following the news in the UK, and we're talking about, it's insane. Angela Rudd, the Tory government, Theresa May, they're asking for businesses to make a list of every worker they have who is a foreigner, that is someone not born in the UK, even if that person happens to be a citizen. They recently told the London School of Economics that if any of their professors were not born in the UK, the government doesn't want their advice. What the hell is going on?
Well, and as part two to that question would be, what color are the stars they want non-citizens to sew onto their clothing?
Yeah, that's our reaction here in Scotland. The first thing that I'd heard about this, I wasn't following the Tory, that's the party that all these people belong to. I wasn't following their party conference because, you know, I have better things to do. So the first thing I saw about this was people using the word Auslander Zentralkartei. I was like, what's that? Oh, that's the name of the similar register of foreign people that another government established, although this one was in 1938 in Germany. This is literally what they are doing. They are enacting a policy that the Nazi government had. Only the Nazi government took 10 years to establish it, here they've taken a year now since the last government elections here. So yeah, it's what the hell is going on? I don't know. And no one else in Scotland seems to have an idea what the hell is going on either.
So if this is how the Tory government is going to act, Scotland's moving towards the door, right?
I think that we were moving towards the door anyway. There was a really good article by one of my contemporaries here, Robin McAlpine, who runs Common Scotland. It's a left of centre think tank / media organisation here. And he was saying he's moved from camp, we're going to be independent in the 2020s, to camp, let's get it done now. And the reason he said that is we need to just get the hell out of here as quickly as possible. And I'm finding a large degree of sympathy with him, because the viewpoint before all of this was, well, okay, Brexit's a thing. We didn't vote for it. We don't want it. We're going to have to wait until the dust settles, see where we are, and then advocate for independence after Brexit and after everything else has happened and the negotiations have happened with the EU, and see if we can find ourselves a place in the world. Now the considered opinion is, we need to get the hell out of here quickly before these guys do anything else, because this is just the start.
Yeah, it's. Oh, I think it is. I think it's the tip of the iceberg. Is May going to allow a leave vote?
I think she can't really stop us. The protocol that was kind of established for your listeners that aren't aware of the very complicated devolution settlement in the UK, it's okay, we're not really understanding it either half the time. The Scottish Parliament exists under laws that are given to it by the UK government, the UK Parliament in Westminster. So Westminster and Holyrood operates under whatever powers it's given by Westminster. And technically speaking, one of them powers is Holyrood has the right to hold votes on things. So Holyrood can hold a referendum, but the Constitution is a reserved matter. It's not devolved. So they don't have the right to hold a referendum on independence that's binding, but they could hold a consultative one. And so because this was a bit of a grey area that no one really knew the exact answer to, in 2013 they signed the Edinburgh Agreement, which was an agreement that London would agree to recognise a referendum and Holyrood would agree to recognise London's power to hold referendums on devolution. So that's the settlement where it is. And to get back to your original question, it's a long-winded explanation. I know it's a very complex subject. To deny us another referendum, we have the Edinburgh Agreement from 2013. The establishment is that if the Scottish people want a referendum, they have the right to have a referendum. That's kind of what the settled viewpoint now. And the Scottish government were very careful, the SNP, my party, put in our manifesto for government this year that if there is an EU referendum and Scotland votes to stay and England votes to leave and we get dragged out against our will, that's a material change in circumstances and we should have the right to call another referendum. They were elected on that manifesto. We have the right of the Scottish people. The Scottish people have said, yes, if this happens, you are the government, you should hold another referendum. And for May to try and deny that, I think in the real politic, it would be bad. I think they just wouldn't try, because they would arm and arm, they would scream about it, and then in the end give in. And the longer they take to give in, the more powerless they'll look in the end. And I think the legal politic of it is, if they tried, we would eventually have to go for UDI, and nobody wants unilateral declaration of independence.
Yeah,
I don't think that we don't want it. Certainly, it's the last thing we want. And the UK government wouldn't want it, because it would just be bad for everyone. So I think in the end, no, May is not going to try and stop us. I think she'll threaten to stop us. But at the moment, what you're hearing from the UK government and what the UK government actually do are two separate things.
Yeah, and to further that point, well, just to explain things for our listeners, the British Constitution isn't real, so it runs on things like convention and backroom deals and agreements. You notice Matt is laughing rather than disagreeing with that. And so what that means...
It's only the rules that govern the entire country. Why would you want them written down in a codified way? No, vagueness is much better.
Yeah, just whatever the government says goes. That's a perfect way to run a country.
For our readers, in other words, the UK really does not have a constitution. They actually do not have a constitution, a document called the constitution.
What we have is a series of hundreds of different laws, some of which contradict each other, conventions based on what happened hundreds of years ago, and gentlemen's agreements between things. For instance, Holyrood isn't allowed to Holyrood legislates on things that it's specifically given powers, and there's an agreement called the Sewell Convention that Westminster won't overrule it on things where Westminster could technically overrule it on everything. There's an agreement that they won't. But it's just an agreement. They could break that at any moment. Mm-hmm. Convention is important in the British Constitution.
Because it's the only reason that things work and function. So because you have a convention, and one of the conventions is, because in their document, in their manifesto, the SNP said, we will hold an independence referendum if this event occurs. It's a convention that they would be considered to have the support of the Scottish people in holding that referendum. If it's in their manifesto, if there's a manifesto commitment, then that's something very important under these conventions. Am I correct on that, Matt?
It's considered the sovereignty system. In England, sovereignty rests with Parliament. It used to rest with the Queen or the King, and now it rests with Parliament. In Scotland, it's always been considered that the people are sovereign. It's an important, but very vague conventional difference there. So the people are sovereign and the people have voted in a government based on this manifesto. If something is in that manifesto, then the government have the right to try and enact it. And for the UK government to try and stop them, rather than just passively saying, okay, you can have a referendum on independence again, we'll not support you in doing so, but you can have it. If they actually try and stop us, that's where you get into very, very dark waters. And bear in mind, the last couple of weeks have been dark. These are unpleasant times. The atmosphere here is one of fear. It's one of uncertainty. I've had foreign people, and I don't use the word foreign generally. I just say such and such is from this other country, but they're a Scots person now because they live in Scotland. I've had people from foreign places, you know, from other European countries actually crying, saying, oh, are we going to get kicked out? Am I going to get dragged out of my house and deported? You know, this is fascism in its early days. So, no, I don't think that May can. But then again, I didn't think that we'd have a Home Secretary standing up and saying we'd have a central register of foreign people. So,
Is Scotland going to wait to see how Article 50 negotiations go between the UK and the EU? Or are you just going to get on with it and get the hell out?
I think it's difficult to say, is Scotland going to do this? Because in reality, it's entirely within the gift of the First Minister, my party leader, to do as she sees fit and have the backing of Parliament if she does so. So I don't know what she's going to do. But at the same time, I think the movement of the country really is, we have this real feeling of the sovereignty of the people. And I think that the people are starting to demand a referendum as soon as possible. Now, obviously, that in the real politic, you know, we need to have a referendum that we're going to be able to win. So there'd be no point holding one tomorrow morning because the polls are saying we'd still lose. So why would we want that? But I think if the polls start moving, I think we'll see a definite pull by everyone to have a referendum sooner rather than later. Ideally, we'd want one before Brexit happens.
Yeah.
So at some point between next March, when Theresa May writes to the European Union, and 2 years after that point, when Britain leaves the European Union, we'd want to have a referendum in that point. And ideally, I'd think that Scotland would be best trying to negotiate with the other EU member states and saying, look, the UK's leaving. We don't want to leave. We've held a referendum on independence. If that referendum passes, put us on a holding pattern. Make us continuing members of the EU for the time it takes to negotiate our exit from the UK, and we'll stay members of the EU. And I think, having talked with friends in the European Union, diplomats, other politicians, people I know, and having had conversations with people who are a lot higher up the chain than me, who had similar conversations, I think there is an appetite in Europe to show goodwill towards Scotland.
I think I even read that Donald Tusk was interested in having Scotland stay in the EU and making that easy for them, for you.
Yes, they have. There's been various people that commented that, yes, we should be welcoming Scotland with open arms. And I think really the politics of the EU, you've got 27 competing member states who all want different things and only come together on issues where they have agreement. But I think there is an agreement that if the EU is to continue, there needs to be, if the UK are leaving, then they need to be shown the door and they need to be shown that they can't have their cake and eat it. So there won't be if they want single market membership, then they need to accept free movement of people. And if they're not having that, then they're not having either. So I think that there needs to be that. And on the other side of that coin, it's a flip side, that if Scotland wants to stay, the EU needs to be welcoming. So mm-hmm. The EU needs to bend over backwards. And people talk about international politics like it's regular politics where it's governed by law. In reality, international law is not worth the paper it's written on. It's convention and agreements. And if the 27 member states agree that Scotland should stay, they will change the rules to let us stay if that's what it's needed.
And they've been willing to do that for literally every other country in the EU. Almost every single country in the EU has some kind of special agreement, special relationship with the EU structure just to make it work. You have the Nordics, you have Norway that doesn't want to officially be in the EU, yet has been willing to accept in certain exchanges methods to get them in the common market so they can trade with anybody else without being officially part of the EU or having to commit to join the euro. And one of the things about committing to join the euro that's really interesting is you just have to say, eventually we'll adopt the euro. But you get to decide under what terms the euro would be adopted. So Scotland could be well within its rights to say, we will adopt the euro under the circumstances that we don't have to obey any of those rules established by the EU bank and are allowed to print currency as a fiat currency as we wish. And if we can't get that agreement, then we won't join. But we're certain that we will eventually get that agreement. And they never will. And we will eventually get that agreement and eventually join the euro at some point in the future. That's the only requirement.
Yeah, I mean, we could actually say, you know, we will join the European Union. We will accept the euro at the point at which the entire European Union begins using Scots Gaelic as its official language. And it's never going to happen, but that's our condition for entry to the euro. And that would be acceptable. So it's Sweden. Sweden will eventually join the European Union. Will eventually join the euro currency at the point at which the majority of Swedes want it. The majority of Swedes will never have the euro as their currency.
Never,
so they're
ever
never
going
have
to happen.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but they will join it eventually.
Sure.
And yeah,
that's where
we'll get around to it. It's on our to-do list. So the four freedoms, what the European Union refers to as the four freedoms, the freedom to move around for goods, services, persons, and capital. When May came out with this statement last week about which essentially said that they are prioritizing, her administration will prioritize the limitation of immigration, basically above all other concerns of the UK. Everything else is secondary. That European EU leaders went nuclear.
Yeah, that is the red line you cannot cross in European politics. You have to accept freedom. You have to accept all of the four freedoms. It's the only thing that makes a single market work. Without it, it would fall apart in minutes. You have to accept the four freedoms, all of them or none of them. You're either in the club or you're not. And Britain has just said, we don't want it to be in the club.
My take on that was that it's hard these days to get the EU to unite over, you know, any number of things. Man, the fastest way to do it is to say something like that. I almost think May did the EU a favor by getting them to unite against a common, you know,
the only light at the end of this particular tunnel is the vague hope that the left in England are clinging to, that somehow this is all just a massive negotiating ploy and that they'll give in on immigration in exchange for something massive from the EU on something else.
They won't. They won't.
No,
they can't.
No, the EU, if that's the case, and I honestly don't think that is actually the case. I think that these people will sacrifice a single market for immigration. But if that's actually the case, that the UK government think they can negotiate using the four freedoms, I think they've massively misread political opinion in Europe. Because what people in the UK don't understand, and your readers over there in the US might not get the same thing as well if they read our tabloid newspapers. And I'm using the word newspaper under advisement, is that the UK seemed that the UK newspapers, particularly the likes of the Daily Mail and the Sun, the Murdoch Press, seem to think that the EU have all these draconian rules and that Britain has just managed to cling on to a couple of minor freedoms, but it's getting a really bad deal out of everything and all these things are horrible. In reality, and that's part of the reason behind Brexit, they managed to push these things about immigrants. In reality, the UK had more opt-outs than any other European nation. They had opt-outs of everything, every single thing. The UK has a little star next to it. The UK does not agree to this. Schengen, the UK does not agree to this. Maastricht, the UK does not agree to this. The euro, the UK does not agree to this. You know, everything, bar the four freedoms, were basically pushed out on the UK. So Europe is kind of fed up of the UK. There was this feeling that, okay, we don't want you to go, but you know what, if you're going to go, at least we won't have to put up with your constant whining. Because yeah. that's what it feels like to the rest of the EU. If you go and talk to German politicians that have had to deal with the UK over the last 20 years, it's just like, yeah, we want to do all these things. Oh, but you know, the UK will never agree to anything. Common defence policy, the UK will never agree to anything. Let's relax common agricultural policy, the UK will never agree to anything. It's just constant. And the European Union, other countries, the other 27 member states, they're just fed up of the UK constantly getting constant, ever-increasing demands about things. So if May thinks that she can negotiate using the four freedoms, she is on to a losing battle there. It is not going to happen. The EU are just going to go, okay, you want out the single market? Go. Bye.
Don't let the door hit you.
We'll let your trade go. You know, we'll work our own trade markets. We'll find some way of doing this. Your trading companies in London will move to Frankfurt, Berlin, Dublin, maybe Edinburgh, I hope. We'll work this out without you.
So it's actually in the EU member states' economic interests to screw the UK. I mean, that's just really obvious that if the EU governments are going to get businesses fleeing from the UK, that seems like there would be no economic reason for them to agree to work with the UK, number one. And number two, I am really concerned, having seen the erratic and irrational behavior of Theresa May's proto-fascist government over the past few weeks, that there was this idea pushed by Farage and the other Leave campaigners that somehow Europe needs the UK more than the UK needs Europe. And that's completely false, because the EU and the common market was what supported the UK through the loss of the empire. When they lost right. all of those foreign markets, they needed another market to sell their goods to so they could keep their factories open. And that market became the European continent that had been completely destroyed by the Second World War. And so this idea that somehow Europe needs the UK more than the UK needs the EU
no,
is false.
No, it's laughable. But anyone with even basic understanding of economics understands that London acts as the EU's clearinghouse. And yeah, that is going to hurt other EU nations, particularly Germany and France and Italy, you know, nations that rely on a lot of financial transactions. That's going to hurt them, particularly financial services stuff. And the fact that the UK is an English-speaking country, it's easier to do business here if you're going to work with Australia, Canada, America, and other countries where English is the lingua franca of the world, basically. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know what? Ireland speaks English.
Yeah.
Yep.
70-odd% of people in Germany have a smattering of English. The Scandinavian countries all speak pretty damn good English.
Yeah.
And Scotland's looking at leaving. Scotland's attached to the rest of the UK by land.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
at the moment, if you move before independence, you'll be a citizen of Scotland as well. We've got a great offer to these people. Come to Edinburgh. Move your company to Edinburgh. I've been in talks with an old school friend of mine. I won't name for obvious reasons. He's got a high-tech company in southeast of England. And all of his workforce, bar two people, I think he employs about a dozen, I think bar two of them, himself and one other, all are EU nationals. They were crying after the vote, saying, what's going to happen to us now? And, you know, they're looking at moving to Ireland. And I said, no, look, I know the relevant government people here. Let's do some business. Let's talk to people. I can put you in touch with the right people. We'll move you to Scotland. And I hope that the rest of the UK's financial market stuff does the same.
Yeah.
Sorry, Alice, you were going to say.
Yes, I was just reading last night that the European Council has come out and said that euro clearing cannot happen in London if the UK is not part of the EU. So what they're saying is euro clearing has to move. It's, you know, move to Frankfurt, move to Dublin, move to Edinburgh. It's got to move. And I think that's going
to
happen.
It's going to move.
Yeah. I don't think there's any question that euro clearing moves. And that's an enormous part of the UK economy right now.
It's an enormous part of the London economy. It's not an enormous part of the North of England's economy, because the North of England barely has an economy. And it's certainly not a big part of Scotland's economy, because Scotland's financial services tend to be more domestic than international. So if that happens, that happens, you know, and Scotland will make the best of what happens. But I would like to see that happen. If that happens, I would like to see us being independent. We can do that. You know, we've got Edinburgh. We've got a financial services sector in Scotland. We're attached to the same landmass. Your people can just get on the motorway up to Scotland. And if they move before independence, they probably qualify for citizenship here as well. So, yeah, bring it on.
I do think, though, that if Scotland is serious about competing for that business, that leave is going to have to make those decisions. I mean, that's going to have to happen fast, because these financial sector companies are going to be making their decisions about where they're moving, you know, now. That's right. And after they've heard this from May, I don't think they have any question but that there's going to be, a serious exodus.
Well, I think there's some of the larger financial companies have already started moving. I've heard rumors, and I can't discuss which bank, but a major European bank, I've heard rumors that they're going to move one of their places of business from London to Frankfurt in the new year. They've already made that decision. They've alerted key members of staff. I might have talked with one of these key members of staff over a few drinks, and I've heard these rumors, you know, that they're basically being told, you know, prepare to start learning German or get another job because we're moving to Germany. Right. They've already decided this based on the fact that, okay, London might not be the clearinghouse anymore. London might be the clearinghouse. They don't know what's going to happen, but they know Germany's not going anywhere.
Right.
So might as well just move to Germany now. There'll be an expense cost of that, but
it'll be less than if you're trying to move into the EU from
these
outside.
People are hedging their bets. They're hedging their bets and saying, okay, it's going to cost us this much to move to Germany, but the uncertainty is worth it.
I need to point out a brief economic fact. We've had a hurricane here in the U.S., and one of the things that always happens, if you look at Katrina, if you look at the four hurricanes that hit Florida in 2004, and if you look at South Carolina's economy over the next year, every time you have a hurricane strike, you have a massive boost to GDP, because GDP doesn't measure economic growth. GDP measures economic activity. And so right now, the UK is seeing a massive economic activity boom because everybody's moving.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at London, London is apparently the actual realtors, you know, the people that do commercial office space and stuff, have seen a massive fall off. Literally, it's just like died a death, because all these companies are saying, okay, can we maybe option our right to leave at 12 months, please? The you know, office space has never been more affordable in London, according to these people. The last 5 years, it's dropped in the last month. And there is a lot of properties changing hands. There are a lot of leases getting signed. There's a lot of properties changing hands. But again, it's like that kind of – the only difference, I would say, is when you look at what happened in Katrina, and the same thing happened in Japan after the horrific tsunami there, you know, that rise in GDP after the storm. This isn't the rise in GDP after the storm. This is the rise in GDP before the storm hits. At the moment, what you're seeing is you're seeing the slight bump from people going out and buying hurricane shelters, you know, to use it. And I don't like to use a comparison. I just like to say, you know, on record, my thoughts are with anyone who's been affected. This looks to be a truly horrendous storm. I know there's been a lot of people who have died in Haiti. I'm sure there'll be a lot more in Florida and the entire panhandle. So my thoughts are with those people at this time, because it must be truly horrendous. But it's one of the things we're blessed with in Scotland. We have constant rain, but we don't have very bad rain. It just feels really bad after 40 days and 40 nights of it. But we don't get horrendous storms that often. They still talk about a storm that happened in the 1980s here, so it must just be horrendous. But you're right about the GDP thing, but this isn't even the storm hitting. This is before. In 2 or 3 years' time, you're going to see what's happened afterwards. You're going to, if you're looking to buy some office space, hold off, because in London, in a couple of years' time, you're going to be able to find quite a lot of it.
They're giving it away, yeah.
They're going to be giving away skyscrapers of it, because there's going to be no one in them. The banks are going. And when the banks have gone, your smaller financial operations follow them. Because it's a famous economist, I think it might have been Keynes. Yeah, a famous economist once said that, you know, that larger companies, it really is like the ocean. You have your big sharks and you have the little fish that attach to the side of them, the lampreys, and then the little fish that follow in their wake, clearing up after them. The big fish are going, the little fish will follow. And when what you're left with is nothing, you will be left with a vacuum. And something will eventually fill that vacuum. I'm not trying to spout the politics of doom and gloom here, but the UK economy is going to be hitting some significant bumps in the next couple of years. You know, the new chancellor there was saying just the other day that the UK economy should be bracing itself for impact. Mm-hmm. When the chancellor of the exchequer, like the secretary of the treasury for your American listeners, is saying that, you know, we're going to have significant impact. That's worrying. Because usually they try and play things down.
Well, Mark Carney, of course, said that before Brexit, and everybody said he was playing politics. He's thinking, no, I'm playing math. But
well, you know, he's Canadian, you know. Who
yeah.
listens to
him? Well, you know, he's going to have to sew one of those whatever color they decide stars on his, you know, Brooks Brothers suit.
I think, I think it's a maple leaf for Canadians.
He gets the maple leaf. Yeah.
We're joking about this, but this is literally fascism.
Yes.
I'm banging my head against the desk here. I'm trying not to shout, but this is literally fascism. If you go to the 1920s when the National Socialist Party, as they were called at the time, was not even in office. They were trying to take office, and then they had a push that failed, and Adolf Hitler went to jail for 2 years. When the policies they were espousing then are not as severe as the ones that are being espoused now. You know, Someone was saying this is hyperbole, they're not fascists. Well, they're acting like the fascists did the last time they rose. They're doing the same things. Yeah. They're registering nationals. They're talking about not listening to experts because they're foreign-born. They're talking about restricting immigration because British jobs for British workers. You know, there was an interview on London Radio a couple of days ago, and the presenter read out a speech and said, you know, Amber Rudd has been talking about doing these things, and read out this speech, and everyone was saying, yeah, this is what she's been saying. And he said, that wasn't Amber Rudd's speech. That was from Mein Kampf. That was a direct lift from Mein Kampf talking about we need to differentiate between whether nationals are people who are working for the good of the country or people who are merely domiciled here, people who merely work here. And people who are working for the good of the state and people who are merely working here. And the language parallels what Rudd was saying exactly. And it's from Mein Kampf. My God, these people. I just don't know what else to say. I could go on for hours about this. You know, when Philip Hammond was talking about not listening to experts because they're foreigners, you know, that's the Chancellor of the Exchequer here. And then saying that the UK economy is going to take a bump. Well, yeah, it's going to take a bump. Everyone who wasn't born in the UK is getting the hell out of here.
Yeah, because you wouldn't want to listen to the head of your central bank. You wouldn't want to listen to the guy who's running the Bank of England because, you know, foreigner. You wouldn't want to take his advice. God forbid. It's
telling the LSE are the ones who are saying, you know, this they've been told by the Foreign Office to stop listening to foreigners. And then the Foreign Office came out and said, no, we didn't say that. And you got the head. Now, normally when you have this sort of argument in public between two major organizations, they'll sit down and say, well, maybe we misunderstood. Maybe we overstated the case. You know, you'll get that kind of, no. The LSE just said, actually, no, that's exactly what you did say. And don't try and lie. And the Foreign Office said, oh, well, we're not lying. Who do you believe, the London School of Economics or the British Foreign Office?
Right.
I'd go for the LSE.
Right. Well, that brings us to the end of the broadcast portion for this interview. Please, please check out our website, imhoppingmad.com, or check us out on Google Play, iTunes, or Stitcher for the extended interview with Math Campbell. Coming up is KGRO in the Morning here on NetRoots Radio. Welcome back to Hopping Mad. We're talking with Math Campbell. Now, we have been talking about fascism here, and one of the questions that I wanted to bring up was, let's talk about the British media. Let's talk about who within the British media has been consistently backing fascist ideology. I've seen a lot from the Daily Mail's history that suggests anti-immigrant stuff back in the 1920s and 30s. And there's even a piece by the newspaper's editor called Hurrah for the Blackshirts, where it backed Oswald Mosley. And it supported fascism on the continent, didn't it?
Yeah, they've always been a right wing paper. Ironically, it's the anniversary of the Battle of Cable Street, where the Black Shirts, Oswald Mosley's Black Shirts, were fought off in 1936 by East Londoners. East London was a place that had quite a lot of what we today call economic activity from people out with the country, so they'd all be on a register nowadays. A lot of people who are of Jewish descent, Germans, French, you know, a multicultural area because it had the Docklands, and these people fought off Oswald Mosley's Black Shirts, and they're the fascists of the time. They tried to be what the Nazi Party were in Germany. In fact, they had links with the Nazi Party, and they were rounded up and put in prison during World War II. And the Daily Mail supported them. And then they said some very nice things about Adolf Hitler. And then after war was declared, of course, the jingoism came in and they decried the Germans. But then they'd still argue for peace occasionally. They'd have the odd editorial where they were arguing that we should make peace with these nice Germans because really we're all just the same and the real enemy is the communists, the Bolshevists, and the Jews. And this is what they did at the time. Now, obviously, they've moved on a lot from since then. But if you look on the internet, you can actually see, you know, images of the Daily Mail in the last few years where they've got hundreds and hundreds of front page stories about immigrants. They've and Muslims and paedophiles. They're the three things that the Daily Mail targets: Muslims, immigrants, and paedophiles. And it's all they ever talk about. And it's really like they haven't moved on. There are people in the Daily Mail, I honestly believe, that would still support Oswald Mosley if he was around today. These people haven't moved on. They are still the same people, the same output, the same fearing of the other. And this is very dangerous because it's the kind of politics that at the moment still gets shunned. But fascism doesn't start with, you know, goose-stepping Nazis out in the street and death camps. It starts with politicians not decrying what's happened in the last week. It starts with newspapers othering people. If you remove the headlines from the 1930s and put them in today's newspapers and replace the word Jew with Muslim, you could actually print them as Daily Mail. It's incredible that this is happening in today's world. And it might well be tied to economic downturns. You tend to see a rise in right-wing politics anytime there is an economic downturn. You're seeing it in the US as well as in the UK. Ooh, you've got Donald absolutely. Trump. And I know we haven't really talked about Donald Trump. And that's, to be honest, a good thing. I think if everyone in the world just didn't talk about Donald Trump, maybe he'd go away. And that would be nice. But since he is here, you know, if you look at some of the things he's been saying, you know, the othering of othering is a good word, the othering of Muslims, the othering of immigration and women as well in the last 24 hours, it seems. Mm-hmm. What a charming man Donald Trump really is. I think I'm going to refer back to, I don't agree with everything the man says, but I'm going to refer back to a guy called Brian Blessed. He's an actor in the UK. Tremendous actor. You might, your listeners might remember him from Flash Gordon. Gordon's Alive, the guy with the beard. And he got stopped outside an award thing early on in the week, and he was asked what he thought about Trump, and he says, "This is just terrible. This man's a buffoon." There are so many brilliant people in America. You've got philosophers and artists and scientists. You've got engineers. You've got people who literally invented space travel and the internet. And this is the best you could do?
Yeah.
What's going on? This is the best you can do? Why are you putting this man on a podium?
Yeah.
Because people who invented the internet and sent us, you know, got us into space and have pushed this country forward on the leading edge of, you know, technology and the arts and so many kinds of things, they don't want to deal with Fox News.
Oh, they're experts as well, and you can't have experts talking about things. They're liberal experts that just talk about their ivory towers all the time. That's another type of othering as well. And you see that a lot more in American politics than this country, but it's starting to happen here as well, where anyone who's an expert, anyone who's considered knowledgeable in something, the likes of Fox News derogate them. They denigrate them and say, "Oh, well, you're just a liberal academic in an ivory tower." No, he's an expert in economics and knows what he's talking about. Just because there needs to be this thing in politics I'm trying to push forward, you need to get away from the idea that just because someone's friendly and the sort of person you might like to go for a beer with doesn't mean that they're maybe the sort of person to run your country.
I've talked about this on the
show
before.
And Trump isn't even nice to talk to.
Yeah. Right. I've talked about this on the show before when my husband and I were first moving to this small town in the middle of America. We were meeting with some people here before we moved, and I have a PhD in physics, and one of the gentlemen in that group said to me, "Darling, unless you can deliver a baby or a calf, you better not go by doctor when you move to this town. It's just going to make things harder on you."
Yeah, because, you know, who needs PhDs in physics? It's actually interesting to note that, you know, Fox News would probably have decried the people who invented the internet because Tim Berners-Lee was English and Wernher von Braun was German. So, sure. You know, immigration is this thing, the hashtag that's been doing the rounds this week, I think has been really brilliant for Scotland. I think maybe America can learn from this, maybe. the We Are Scotland hashtag, and it's basically been people coming out and saying, I was born in Lithuania and my partner's from Poland, but we live in Scotland because we are, and we are Scotland. It yeah. doesn't matter where you're born. And the motto of English Scots for Yes has been taken up by everyone as a whole. They're not giving us credit, but they've taken the motto, so that's good enough for us. And it's not about where you were born, but where we're going together as a country. Why should it matter that someone's from France or that their father came from Ireland? Or if you're in America, that you were brought up in Mexico before you moved to America. You're here now. You're living and working here. You're contributing to the economy. You're presumably paying your taxes. Donald Trump doesn't, but, you know, the immigrants do.
Yes.
If you're paying your taxes, you're living and working here. You're bettering the country. Why the hell does it matter where you come from? You're American. If you live here, you're Scottish. If you live there, you're American. That's all that matters.
Yeah.
And this is just, you know, the othering of these people. And people that have an education, it's disgraceful. The right wing need to take a step back and realize that they're just harming themselves doing this. You know, Republican politics has gone down the gutter in the last 5 years, and it's largely because anyone that's actually got a clue stays clear of them. Because why would you want to step into that mess? They're going to just denigrate you for having a doctorate.
Some time ago, Will spoke on the show about Scotland actually needing immigrants. Is that still the case there?
Yeah, we've got a population decline. We've got a declining population. We've got the remnants of the baby boom, which is pushing up our elderly statistics. So we've got an aging, declining population. We need more people. We desperately need people with the right kind of training to fill our skills gaps. We've got skill gaps in healthcare. We've got skill gaps in IT. We really do need 5,000 programmers and 5,000 nurses like yesterday morning. And if you're a doctor, you know, please come on in. And the worst thing is we don't control our immigration policy. London does. And London's just basically said, oh, if you're a foreign healthcare worker in the UK, you can stay for a little while till we can train up some British people to replace you. That's just incredible. It's literally like fascism from the 1930s. I keep going back to this comparison. But these people are using the same language that the Nazis used and the fascists in Italy used. What else can you... At some point, Godwin's law kicks in and says, oh, if you just compare everyone to the Nazis, you're just being hyperbole. No, at some point, they are acting like Nazis. What more can you say?
Yeah. Well, that's factual. And what I remember is there's this British film that I tried to track down for a long time, ever since I heard about it and finally was able to get my hands on a copy, called It Happened Here. And it was an anarchist film from the 1930s and 40s in the UK. I think it was made during World War II. And it was about a fascist takeover of Britain. And it was hugely controversial because it actually allowed black shirts to have conversations and portray themselves and their ideas in the film. And it was anti-fascist, of course. But one of the things one of the black shirts says is, you know, they're talking about expelling Jews and to communists and getting rid of all these undesirable, un-English people specifically. And One of them pipes up and says, but, you know, the thing is, these are our skills that they've been taught. So since they're our skills that have been created by Western civilization, we should keep them around until our own people are able to do these jobs. That's actually in a film coming out of the mouth of an actual British fascist who is marching around goose-stepping with Mosley. These are fascist ideas.
Yeah. People think fascism is, you know, like the SS marching down the road with their black helmets and their guns. No, that's not how fascism arrives. Fascism, to quote Star Wars, this is how fascism, this is how liberty dies, with thunderous applause. It's populism. It's someone standing up and saying, and see those immigrants, we better get rid of all of them guys, and we'll be putting more money into British workers. That's fascism. That's the way it starts. It starts softly. It's not the death camps and the Gestapo raiding everyone outside your street. It's the softly soft drip of poison every day in the media, every day from the politicians, no one speaking out against it. And it's devastating as an English person who moved to Scotland. I love Scotland, but I still love England, and it's devastating to see England is swallowing and falling for this. But I live in Scotland and I want what's best for Scotland. So, yeah, we're leaving as soon as we physically can. I'm advocating that we hold a referendum next year. Other people are saying 2018 might be more realistic. I'm fine with that. But before the UK leaves the EU, I want to be out of here, because the only thing holding back the Tories in the UK right now is being in the EU because of the European human rights laws. The European Convention on Human Rights is applicable under British law. They want to remove that. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't understand how anyone can justify getting rid of a human rights convention that literally was the basis for the UN's policies on human rights. They want to rip that up and replace it with our own. Why? What's wrong with it? Oh, well, it's got too much red tape in it. No, it hasn't. It stops you doing horrendous things and masking it under the terms of, we've got a Human Rights Act, so it's fine. They want to get rid of the protection that stops, the legal protection that allows people to sue the British government if our armed forces kill people.
Yeah, I saw that.
They want to allow atrocities to be committed and not have to worry about being sued.
And the aspect of that is, I'm looking at Northern Ireland, and the Good Friday Agreement is based on Northern Ireland being in the EU. That is what makes the Good Friday Agreement function, is that people who are involved in that conduct and that conflict will have access to EU courts, will have access to EU human rights conventions, because that means that there's a neutral arbiter that these various sides can trust, instead of it being in local courts or British courts, which one half of that conflict don't trust because they don't want to be a part of the United Kingdom. So that is an extra level of what's worrying about this, is the consequences of this for Northern Ireland. I'm looking at this giant mess that's been created, and
the worst thing is the people who created the mess didn't even think it was going to happen.
Yeah.
And Boris Johnson was actually caught talking to someone saying, don't worry, it will never happen. He's one of the architects of this damn thing. And what did he do? He immediately walked away. And now he's the foreign secretary.
Well, he and Nigel Farage immediately bailed.
Yeah. And why wouldn't they? Because they've made a mess and they know they're going to get held accountable for it. But, I mean, the Northern Irish thing, I'm not going to dwell too much on that. But I think Northern Ireland has enough problems of its own without English, Scottish politicians wading in and muddying the waters. So I'm sensible enough not to comment too much. But I would say I'd agree with you that the Good Friday Agreement is based on European law. The Northern Irish situation with the Republic of Ireland, it's not perfect, but it's been working fairly well for the last 15 years. Yes. I think messing with that is a very, very bad idea. And yet these people are doing exactly that. And the worst thing is they didn't even care that they're doing that. They didn't do this thinking, well, we'll work out something about Ireland. They just didn't think about Ireland because Ireland's not part of London. Really, the UK right now is two different states. It's London and everything else outside of London, because that's how they see things. And everything happens outside of London doesn't really matter. They knew that this was likely to cause Scottish independence, but they thought, that's all right, we'll deal with the Scots later. Because that's how they see it. We'll deal with the Scots. We will deal with them, because we is Britain and Britain is London and England, whereas them is Scotland, and Scotland's part of the UK, but only as a sufferance to them. They don't want us. They want our oil. That's they want our resources. That's how it sits. And same with Northern Ireland. So I think it is a very dark place for the whole UK right now. I'm not bailing on the whole rest of the UK, but we're in Scotland and we're leaving. Sorry. Maybe our example will show a positive example to the rest of the UK to rise up and say, no, this is wrong. I don't know.
But. Now, did you say earlier that Leave is still not polling high enough?
Well, we don't use the term Remain and Leave because it's not associated with the best people in the world. We prefer yes and no, yes to independence, and the no camp being the unionists. That's just a terminological exactitude there. Yes is not quite at the level we'd like. Polling is always difficult. Polling never gets things 100% right. We're seeing some polls are saying it's about 50-50. Some polls are saying it's 48-52. It was at 45-55 in 2014. So we have moved on slightly, but we think there's quite a large number of people who swallowed the lies about the European Union and would have voted for independence but don't want to be in the European Union if they can leave. So we've lost some to that. We've gained some, but we've lost some. So I think we're probably, if we're not at 45-55, we're probably a little bit ahead of it, but not by much. So we have some work to do. I think the government would be foolish to call a referendum before we're sure we can win.
Yeah.
But so equally, I think we will be sure we can win.
I think my guess would be that the May administration's decision to go with a hard Brexit is going to influence Scotland.
my hunch is it already has. In the last week, I've seen so many people coming onto Twitter saying, okay, this is the last straw. I'm voting yes. If there's another referendum, we're leaving the UK. They've literally changed their mind in the last week. And okay, mercurial politics can be difficult to base decisions on. People might flip back, but I don't think it will. I think it's already had an actual effect. I would like to see polling. If I had a polling company right now and millions of pounds to spend on it, I would put out a poll right now to see where people are compared to a month ago. And my hunch is there'd be at least 2 or 3 points up. I wouldn't be surprised if it's above 50. And here's the critical point. When we start to see poll after poll coming in showing support for independence above 50%, I think that will unleash the tidal wave. I think that's when people will just say, okay, it's actually going to happen. Well, I want to be on the winning side. No one wants to be a loser. You see this in politics a lot. When it becomes an inevitable result, suddenly everyone's voting for it. It happened in Norway when they had their referendum on independence. The polls there were showing about 60%. This was 1901, I think. And then overnight, it went from 60 or 70% in favour to 99% in favour. Because everyone thought, well, it's going to happen. I might as well vote for it. And I think that same thing will happen here once it becomes inevitable. But equally, I think, and this is, I would appeal to, if there's any European diplomats listening, I'd appeal to you. We need your help now. In the words of Alan Smith, our member of the European Parliament, you know, Scotland hasn't let you down, Europe. Please don't let Scotland down now. We need European Union to come in and say, yeah, we'd welcome you with open arms and we'll definitely put you in a holding pattern and let you stay European Union members whilst you negotiate to leave the UK if that's what you want to do. That's all we need. We need it just written down that will happen. I think that would be the last straw that keeps us from going independent break.
Well, I think that you're in luck because I think that Merkel and Hollande and, you know, company are mad enough now that they want to put the hurt on the UK. They basically said that in their press conference this week, that they're ready to put the hurt on the UK. They're ready to make it painful for the UK to go through hard Brexit. So if that's what it adds to the pain if they welcome Scotland with open arms.
Well, you heard the comments of Guy Verhofstadt. I think I can never pronounce his name properly.
Verhofstadt.
Yes.
The Belgian politician. He was the Belgian prime minister, and he's now been unofficially made, I think, the chief negotiator for
Article
50 the
negotiator.
EU.
Yeah.
He's basically their head Brexit negotiator now, and as a result, you know, he said yes, we should be welcoming of Scotland. Yes, there will be a pathway for Scotland to have continuing membership. Now that's important. Continuing membership. Not we would look at Scotland joining favourably, but continuing membership.
Right.
And that could be critical because the difference between being dragged out of Europe for a couple of years and having to wait and re-enter and having continuing membership could be amazingly big for European companies that are based in the UK, because overnight they can move from London to Scotland and they don't leave the EU ever. They don't leave the EU. They don't have to change anything. They don't even have to change currencies for a while. You know, that could be literally the turning point where we see a lot of business and commercial and industrial sector support for independence grow. Last time around, we had a lot of companies that were very against Scottish independence. I think it could be the other way around this time. I think we could see the Asdas and the Walmarts and the banks of the country coming out and saying, yeah, Scotland should be independent.
Well, wasn't part of the worry that for those companies that they might be out of the EU and they didn't want any uncertainty about losing their EU membership? So now that this is going to guarantee their membership of the common market.
Well, exactly. That's the thing. The other thing to note, we tend to dwell every time we've been on and we've dwelled about Scottish independence. Sorry, it's an occupational hazard. the other thing to note that different between 2014 and now is in 2014, the Labour Party had influence in Scotland. Now the Labour Party do not. The Labour Party are gone. That was the UK government, the UK establishment's chief vector in Scotland was the UK Labour Party. They poured everything through the Scottish Labour people like Gordon Brown. Whereas now these people have no credibility. The Tories are reviled in Scotland. They were very, very loudly proclaiming that they were on the march and that they came second. They came second with less than 20% of the vote. They've not gone anywhere. It's just Labour's gone down even further. So I think that the combination of financial institutions, commercial all businesses and Labour, you know, all supporting independence and Labour disappearing overnight, and the Unionists being bound up with the Tories. Tories are losing ground in Scotland. I think that that could actually mean we get independence. I am now more certain than ever that Scottish independence will happen, and I'm more certain than ever that we will be independent by 2020, I think.
Let's talk about Labour for a moment, because there's
it's always fun.
Yeah, and right?
Yeah.
No, it's Jeremy Corbyn didn't fight Brexit. He's not coming out against the Tories and calling this fascism. He's not fighting this stuff. Where the hell is the Labour Party in defending left-wing principles in the left-wing? They're supposed to be the biggest left-wing party in the UK. What the hell are they doing?
If I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't be sitting here. I'd be working as a consultant to the UK Labour Party, because they don't really know what they're doing either. I think the problem is that they've gotten so wound up in this internecine, inter-party fight they're having with each other about who gets to control the Labour Party, the Blairites versus the Corbynites, also known as Old Labour versus New Labour. And this fight goes back 30-odd years. As a consequence, these people are very angry with each other, so they've had plenty of time to hate each other. And because of all that, they really don't. It's not that they don't care what's going on in the wider world. They just they've only got so much time on their hands, and they're spending it stabbing each other in the back. Tony Blair has indicated he might come back into frontline politics. That would be amusing. But the UK Labour Party are nowhere. They have no opposition to the Tories in England. They're dead in Scotland. They're dying in Wales. They never had a foothold in Northern Ireland. And as a consequence, there is no. I think this is why we're seeing the Tory government going for this hard Brexit, appeasing UKIP style of politics, because they're where the votes are. The Labour Party aren't going to get any votes in England, because there isn't one, really. For all intents and purposes, they're all but dead in the water at the moment. So, yeah, of course they're going to UKIP, because that's where the votes are. They're covering their base. They're making sure that they can't get outrighted on the right of them. And they can't get outvoted on the left, because there isn't any left. The left is dead. So, yeah, this is driving the Tories. The Tories are going to the hard right. And this is Labour's fault. Thanks, Labour. Corbyn, I don't understand where Corbyn is, because, you know, as you said, he didn't fight for Brexit. He didn't push hard on that. They've been bound up in their leadership contest for so long now, and they've just gotten back control, and he's just won their control there, that they've not been providing effective opposition in Westminster. The SNP, the third party of the UK Parliament, you know, my party, we only have 50, 55, 56 MPs. And yet we're still providing more effective opposition than the Labour Party, who have over 200. Because we're there, we're turning up. You look, if you go on to C-SPAN and watch the UK Parliament debates, you'll see a block on the left-hand side of the chamber towards the back, in the usual camera position. That's the SNP block, because our MPs turn up. The Labour Party don't. They're not there in debates, they're not there in positions, they're not fighting against the Tories. If anything, they're actually going to the right as well. There was a thing from the Labour Party, not to drone on about this, there was a thing from the Labour Party out this week. The only criticism they had of the Tories was that the Tories said they were going to crack down on immigration, and they haven't, and that they push harder on immigration than the Tories. They're trying to outright the Tory party.
On immigration. And this is something that goes back to Ed Miliband. Ed Miliband, as part of the Labour Party swag during the last election, had controls on immigration as one of his there was like a big gravestone for Labour that they put a bunch of things on, and controls on immigration was part of it. They sold T-shirts and coffee mugs with the words controls on immigration on it. Like, when the Democratic Party is looking and saying, actually, you know, we need immigration reform, we need a pathway to citizenship, we're fighting to make sure that these people's rights are respected and that we have a sane immigration system that allows people into the U.S. who can find work here, where we're fighting on behalf of the Latino community and on behalf of fixing these problems, the Labour Party isn't providing left-wing opposition. They're saying, yeah, we do need controls on immigration. Yeah, there is too much in for immigration. Yeah, the Tories are right. You can't beat these people by agreeing with them.
No, they're not agreeing with them. They're actually arguing with them that they're not doing enough. These people were actually arguing about there's a camp in Calais, and I think the French government are disgraceful for allowing these camps to exist.
The jungle, yeah.
I think they should be integrating these people into French society, and if they wish to claim asylum elsewhere, then well, that's another matter. But they shouldn't be just holding them into camps. I think that's disgraceful. But putting that aside, there's a camp at Calais that the French government and the British government jointly manage to control asylum seekers to the UK, and they process their aspects of their immigration there. And the UK government wants to build a big wall around it because the wall's not effective enough. And Labour are criticising, saying that the wall isn't big enough, that they need to build an even bigger wall. What the hell's going on? This is supposed to be the left. They're supposed to be the ones that fight this sort of proto-fascist nonsense. And instead, their only comment is that wall's not big enough. I'm surprised they're not saying, you know, build some watchtowers.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So, head of the Scottish National Party is Nicola Sturgeon. What's she up to? What are her priorities, do you think, right now?
We've got
speaking
this
of
whole
leadership. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean, we've got I couldn't speak for her or for the party. I'll put the standard disclaimer
yeah,
in there. We've got these we've got multiple focuses really, because there's the constitutional situation, there's the Brexit situation, and the two are connected obviously, but there's Brexit and then the Scottish independence. And there's also there's trade. She was in Iceland the other day. They're promoting cross-border tourism with Iceland and Scotland because we're both actually small countries with similar tourism strategies. So we're sharing knowledge there, and that's great. And I think that's actually a very positive thing. We're trying to highlight our common similarities with the Nordic countries. Scotland is really a Nordic country. Our language, the Scots language, has a lot of Norse in it, and the Arcadians up on the islands that surround Scotland, if you're looking at the map, it's the little speckly ones on the far left there. They have a Nordic language. They speak a version of Old Norse called Arcadian. But, you know, so we're promoting them, but we've also got the domestic agenda, which sometimes gets lost because, you know, newspapers only have so many inches to fill. And we really have to, I think the biggest priority of the Scottish government isn't independence, it isn't the Brexit situation, and it isn't trade. All of those are important. I think the biggest thing we're actually looking at is educational attainment, because right now, Scottish schools, we're not getting a good enough attainment in impoverished areas. That's something that the Scottish government are spending a massive amount of money on this term. You know, also for early years childcare and for nurseries, they're adopting the Finnish baby box, which is brilliant. This is a box that's given to all prospective parents containing blanket and food and nappies and various things they need. They're increasing the Sure Start maternity grants, all these sorts of things. It's a very domestic agenda that's actually occupying Parliament, and Parliament is apparently working very hard at the moment. I was talking to an MSP, not one of our MSPs actually, and saying he's never worked so hard. It's been very productive recently. So the domestic agenda often gets swallowed up. It's like US politics. The domestic agenda often gets swallowed up by the sexy stuff on the front pages. But really, the work of government has to carry on no matter what's going on the front pages, no matter what's happening in England with proto-fascists announcing their registry of foreigners. The government of business, the business of government has to carry on in the background. And some of it's actually really, really vital stuff that should hopefully grow our economy despite the UK government's attempts to destroy us all. I mean, and if any of you have, you know, looked at the currency markets, this is just apocalyptic what's happening right now. There was a report from I think it might have been the LSE. There was a report suggesting that the UK sterling would reach 110 against the dollar by 2017, or the end of 2017.
Bank of Japan has projected that sterling will go down to 1.05 against the dollar.
Yeah, this one was saying it was going to go to 110 against the dollar by the end of 2017. And I looked at it and went, no, it's going to go to that by the end of the month if this carries on. It's already at 115.
Yeah.
It was at 115 briefly during a plummet. The people are going on about the debate about this currency situation, saying, oh, it's because of automatic trading. It was algorithmic trading caused a quick loss.
The flash crash this week, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's what caused it at that point. The trend is being caused by UK-based businesses going, no, we're getting out of here quickly as possible, and everyone slowly dumping sterling. My only surprise is that these crashes aren't happening more often, because everyone's trying to get rid of their sterling because they know the future is not good.
Just
you know,
to
they
explain,
see the roadmap, and it's
right.
It's not going a good place.
Just to explain real quickly about the flash crash to listeners, what happened this week was that pound sterling suddenly, basically in the middle of the night, beginning of the trading day in the Asian markets, suddenly fell off a cliff. And what they tried to say about it was that it was all of these algorithms that trade automatically that kicked in for a variety of reasons. But what they don't say is that one of the things that gets calculated into these algorithms, or into many of these algorithms, is things like leading memes on Twitter and headlines. Those things are actually part of the algorithm. They actually have news bots, essentially, that look for bad news. And when those algorithms hit all the bad news this last week out of the UK, they calculated that in, and the pound dropped like a stone.
Yeah, it dropped like a stone, but on a flash crash. And they're saying, oh, okay, it's just a flash crash, and we're going to investigate ways of stopping these algorithm trading from happening. I think that's daft, but that's not the big problem. The big problem is that if you look at the 1 month, yeah, if you take out the bumps, it's still going down. It is going to be hitting, you know, I honestly expect I will see parity with the dollar within a year or two.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe sooner, depending on how this goes, we will see parity. And well, in my lifetime, it's never happened.
The real problem underlying that is that what the algorithms were taking into consideration was bad news. There's that much bad news out there. The problem wasn't the algorithm. The problem was the bad news.
Yeah, as with usual with many governments, they're trying to fix the problem by slapping a Band-Aid on the symptom. Now, the symptom is caused by the bad news. As you say, it's not the algorithms that are to blame. They're just to blame for the ups and downs on a daily basis.
Right.
The actual bad news is what's to blame. Everyone's dumping sterling. That's what's causing the flash crashes. That's what's causing, you know, these massive trading differences. It's because everyone's dumping sterling, or why wouldn't they? It's going to be worth nothing in a few years' time if this carries on. So, you know, it's bad
hey,
for
hey,
all
hey.
Of us.
It's going to have dollar parity. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's going to be worth nothing. And
no. U.S. dollar, not Canadian dollar, Matt. Be fair.
Do Canadians have a dollar?
Yes.
Didn't know that. No, I'm kidding. I know about the loony. The problem with the parity situation, the reason why this is bad though, is because UK businesses depend on trading a lot more. We're an island nation, and Scotland's not an island nation. We have a southern border, but you know, the UK as a whole is an island state. So we depend a lot more on exports and imports than a lot of other countries that are landlocked in Europe, where you can get goods and services over the border. We can't do that because you have to get on a boat to be over the border here. So, you know, these issues of international economics, I mean, I don't claim to be an economist, but, you know, these issues are going to get worse. For instance, you know, I do a lot of work when I'm not being a politician. I'm a graphic designer and web designer, and I do a lot of work with American clients. And about 6 months ago, I set my hourly rate. I changed it from being set in sterling to being set in dollars. Because, you know, my work's going down.
Yeah.
And I'm not working for less just because the pound's going down. It's glad I did that now.
Yes,
but
no, good
it's,
move.
It's a real problem, though, because, you know, I'm a small graphic designer. But when you look at international companies, you know, the pound is now worth so much less. It's going to be, if you're a British-based business, why wouldn't you move elsewhere? This is why I think the Scottish currency situation should be a Scottish pound tied to euro or tied to dollar or tied to a basket of currencies rather than a Scottish pound tied to sterling or just sterling itself. I think the currency movement has moved on. Anyway, sorry, I was going on too long there.
No. And I would love to have that currency discussion with you in more detail as things with Scottish independence move forward, because I think that's a fascinating conversation. And we touched on it a little bit before when you were on this show with us in the past. And I'd like to get back to that because, of course, that's one of my deep loves. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's the bit I don't know about. You would love that, yeah. Well, the reason I drag it in, really, it's the whole issue of Scottish independence is fascinating from a political/governmental point of view, even if you're not Scottish and have any interest in the actual realities of it. It's fascinating because we're talking about a modern nation reinventing itself and working out how is best to govern itself. And much like, instead of renovating an old home, if you're demolishing it and building a new one, you can do all the things that you'd never have been able to do before that we can do with the modern world. We can have e-voting to do stuff. We can bring in new structures that are recognizant of the 21st century that you just couldn't do in an existing country because it was too much upheaval. We're going to have the upheaval anyway, so we can do interesting things. We can have, you know, electronic currencies that are primarily electronic and have fiat tokens for cash use. You can do all these things because we've got all that chance. I think that's why it's a fascinating opportunity for any politics people out there. And if you want to come to Scotland and study it, you know, we welcome you. We're still welcoming of people from overseas.
Yeah, just good luck getting past the UK. Getting past the UK border agency who are trying to keep everyone out.
Yeah, don't look too foreign to them.
Right.
It's not a good idea.
So I should throw on a kilt while I'm on the airplane, right? That'll totally make me look not foreign.
Yeah, that'll absolutely make you look like an English guy coming to a wedding, yes.
Excellent.
Sorry, that's for your listeners, that's a joke. The only people who wear kilts in Scotland are English people on holiday coming up for a wedding.
That's hilarious.
Not true. It's not true, but it's a stereotype that you see a drunk guy in a kilt. Oh, look, there's an English guy up to a wedding. But yeah, we really are welcoming. We're a welcoming country. And if I commend your listeners, look on Twitter. If you use Twitter, look on there, type in the hashtag #WeAreScotland, and you will see some truly heartwarming posts from people.
Yeah, it is, really.
You're an existing country.
I took a look yesterday. Activism. Anyway, Matt, thanks so much for joining us. It was fascinating as usual, and we just love having you and hope you'll come back and talk to us more
anytime
as this
like.
Progresses. Folks, you can catch us on Stitcher, iTunes, and Google Play at our website, imhoppingmad.com. And now we're on Instagram, too, where you can go and see what Team Arliss has to say about political issues during the week. We'll be back next week here on Hopping Mad.